Right now, it's Friday, September 9th, and on this approximate day, 218 years ago, something happened that changed American agriculture forever. I'm Sarah Mock, and this is Ag Interrupted. I think most people in agriculture, especially the kind who listens to a podcast like this, has probably a passing familiarity with the Haber-Bosch process. This chemical technology, discovered in Germany in 1909, is famously credited with enabling the lives of billions of people as it revolutionized the production of chemical fertilizers, allowing nitrogen, in the form of ammonia, to be distilled out of thin air. Today, the Haber-Bosch method is at the heart of much of the global fertilizer industry, pumping out the N in NPK in a way that almost makes it seem like Haber-Bosch invented the fertilizer industry. Like, before this process was discovered, it was all farm-raised manure or nothing. That, naturally, is not true. In fact, there was an incredibly global fertilizer industry that predates Mr. Haber and Mr. Bosch by nearly 100 years. And as we look around at our modern fertilizer industry, mired in unpredictability, rising and falling at the whim of outside forces, I'm going to argue that it's actually this earlier period of the fertilizer trade that has the most important lessons to teach us today. So that's what we're going to do. We'll start by digging into the earliest years of the global fertilizer trade and excavate some lessons learned by one of the first crop nutrient boom and bust cycles. Then we'll jump ahead to today and use our new lens to understand where the modern fertilizer industry stands now and what might be ahead. But let's start with the pre-Haber-Bosch world of fertilizer first. This is a wild story, and I wanted to find someone who could share not only the facts, but who could also bring it to life. So I tracked down Dr. Greg Cushman, who spoke to me from his home office, where he keeps a reminder of this important era right by his desk.
Here it is on the shelf. Hold on a sec.
Greg's a global environmental historian at Arizona State University. And like you, I couldn't smell what Greg was showing me. But he could.
Oh, I have lots of bags around it because it smells wonderfully of wet dog. I have it quadruple bag. This makes me laugh. This is the best birthday present ever. My parents gave me a bag of Tintin 2 genuine seabird guano from Peru. There you can see the Peruvian. You know, tropical island Peru, right? And a t-shirt that they got at their local garden show.
Today, guano is something of a novelty, outside Peru at least, but that wasn't always the case. And the history of the mid-1800 guano boom is a fascinating one. It starts with that lovely, fragrant bird dung, which at the time we didn't understand very well chemically, even though today we recognize it as a premium, almost magical, naturally occurring fertilizer.
The most lucrative and valuable guano islands are found off the coast of Peru, the desert coast. The reason the guano is so valuable is that rain is extremely infrequent, even unheard of in some locales. So the ammonia that has the nitrogen that makes this so valuable as a fertilizer, it's got phosphate and potassium too, but the nitrogen didn't get leached away, didn't evaporate away. As it got buried with other layers of guano, it was preserved anywhere from 8 to 16% by weight, which is, that's miracle grow strength. And it also was a complete fertilizer, and folks figured that out.
The first people to figure this out, of course, were indigenous Peruvian farmers who had been using guano as part of their agricultural practice for thousands of years. But the first European to learn of guano discovered it in the early 1800s, which kicked off the Anglo obsession with the stuff.
In the aftermath of the German explorer Alexander von Humboldt's visit to the coast of Peru, he ran across barges of guano that was being shipped for use on local farms and local plantations when he was there watching mercury pass off the face of the sun to measure the latitude of Lima. And he'd done a lot of chemical experimentation himself, and he could smell what we now know as ammonia with his nose. It's like, oh, that's interesting stuff. What do you use this for? As he sneezes his lungs out because he took too big of a whiff. Hey, can I get a sample of that stuff to take home? Or actually several samples, please. Which he gave to several of his most important patrons the moment he got back to Europe from his journeys in late 1804, 1805. And then those people who were studying it published about, oh, look at this interesting substance from Peru.
The date von Humboldt first noticed guano is not precise. But given that Mercury traversed the sun on November 9th of 1804, and that September and October are traditional planting times in Peru, September 9th seemed like a pretty good guess. Back to the story, though. One of these publications that Greg mentioned, Elements of Agricultural Chemistry, was reportedly the most widely read work on agriculture by the world's English-speaking farmers to date, and interest in guano in the U.S. was peaked.
Now, the export of this stuff in mass quantities did not happen overnight. Really crucial event was the Wars for Independence in South America, particularly in Peru. And not unlike the USA, some of the key founding fathers of the South American republics were very much advocates of science and the use of science for technological and economic improvement. So they brought teams of experts from Europe to help rebuild scientific institutions, to establish schools of mining, to engage in experiments with various natural substances that then they would publish with the hopes of creating new lucrative industries and enriching the new Latin American republics.
And there were guano islands all over the world, including many prominent examples in and around the Caribbean and in the Pacific, near Peru all the way to Australia. These mountains of guano could pretty easily be excavated and returned to the east coast of North America and Europe, and both American and British farmers were hungry to experiment with this new fertilizer.
Improving farmers, especially those who owned and managed large, lucrative estates in places like Britain, plantations in the U.S. South, to just name a couple, many of them were avid experimenters, saw themselves as scientists using their findings to grow more stuff, to produce more nutritious feed for their livestock was one of the big motivations, to look good to their neighbors, to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. And partly through trial and error, but increasingly using developing chemical theories. For example, the mineral theory of plant nutrition figured out that additives given to the soil could benefit plant growth, sometimes spectacularly.
And as farmers grew more and more hungry for guano, the United States refused to be left out of the trade. Though it would never be as dominant or influential in the guano business as the British, the trade did inspire the U.S. to make some unprecedented moves on the global stage.
The United States made a point in terms of the government to provide official support for its citizens to establish claim to remote islands, even rocks in the middle of the ocean that didn't have any clear claimant. Basically, how this happened is that the whaling industry enters into the Pacific at the end of the 18th century and is going all over the place in search of sperm whales. These whalers didn't just take sperm whales, they would trade in anything that they could get to carry back. So they'd go to islands looking for sandalwood that could be traded with China. They would go looking, trading for otter skins, furs, seal skins, any number of things. So this is part of a movement by merchant seamen, especially of Massachusetts and of New England, to look for things out on the edges of the world.
I find it fascinating to think that some of the earliest vestiges of our modern, uber-complex, and often fragile supply chains started with these whalers. But they were just the beginning. Other cargo transport vessels, especially trading in fine metals in Latin America, contributed to the growth in Pacific trade, alongside passenger ships full of miners from New York and Baltimore, destined for Californian gold fields. To take full advantage of this new Pacific movement, the U.S. government instituted the Guano Island Act of 1856, allowing its citizens to claim territories they discovered, especially in the Pacific and the Caribbean, that had no clear claim from another state or power.
Didn't work that way sometimes. One of the reasons is because some of these places were indeed claimed by other people, most famously La Navas or Navassa Island off of the second independent state of the Americas, the Black Republic of Haiti. United States came in and using the Guano Island Act and two gunboats that parked off the island to prevent Haiti from taking them back, took an island right off the coast of Haiti and said, no, this is unclaimed land. We're going to take everything off here. They worked that island for several decades, especially taking phosphate rock to Baltimore, where it was processed into superphosphate fertilizer and then used on fields in the Chesapeake area.
Hate to point it out, but I wonder what you'll think of the similarities this story shares with a current event, one in which a powerful, resource-hungry country uses their military dominance to take resources from their neighbor. The violence that was inflicted upon workers of Navassa Island was horrific. Despite the fact that the island was mined in the aftermath of the Civil War, slavery only ended on Navassa Island after the guano ran out. The Guano Island Act was more than an economic move for the U.S., however. It was a geopolitical action that would affect not only much of the 1800s, but much of the two centuries that followed it as well.
Establishing these places as claimed territories on the other literal other side of the planet was a crucial precedent for the United States of America making claim not only to territorial empires on the North American continent, but especially to new colonies like Puerto Rico, Hawaii, the Philippines, that happened in the late 1890s. And also to intervene in the affairs of other states, especially in the Western Hemisphere. Fights over guano and guano islands inflamed a number of diplomatic incidents, and in a couple cases, all-out wars, not only involving the United States, but other colonizing powers.
Perhaps these far-ranging impacts seem distant and unimportant from the view of the Farmgate, but Greg argues that what guano did for, or maybe to, American and global agriculture is even more pivotal and has continued to define the way we practice farming through today.
Guano is, in some ways, a completely traditional animal manure that is not unlike collecting the stuff from your chicken coop or from your sheep paddock or from the corral where you have your cows and then putting it onto your fields. Something that, again, these are ways that farmers have manipulated the fertility of their soils and helped maintain the fertility of their soils over the long term. They're key to sustainability of intensive agriculture. You have to keep adding things as you take away things in any kind of intensive agricultural system. So guano, in some ways, is the Trojan horse. And was never envisioned that it was do this when it started. It's a Trojan horse because in some ways it's the same kind of thing that's always been used. But the thing that's different is that it is premised on extractivist relationships with natural environments in far distant locales. And the sheer quantities that we use these things, also with creating waste, including the waste nutrients themselves that flow into waterways, that get into the soil, that bacteria eat and then spew out nitrous oxides, which are the third most important driver of global warming from greenhouse gases right now. The basic logic of this is to take advantage of something off farm from far away that you can then use to increase the amount of stuff you produce that you can then ship off farm to make a profit. Paying very little attention, unfortunately, and oftentimes to what's happening to that source environment, and also to what happens downstream, both in the air and in the water, from one's agricultural field.
I like the imagery here of the Trojan horse, with guano serving as the familiar enough farm input that convinced farmers to open their gates and begin to learn a different kind of agriculture, dependent not just on finite resources like bird poop from distant islands. It also prompted them to accept a vastly complex logistical system that was necessary to bring it from island to farm, and the many natural, political, and social risks that threaten to disrupt those systems all the time. Extractive ag inputs have surely helped facilitate a more abundant supply of crops in the world, in some ways and in some places, an overly abundant supply. But they've also left us with a lot of problems and a tremendous amount of risk. And when we look to the past to gain insights for the future, the outlook is kind of bleak. The global guano industry had profound impacts, both on American geopolitics and on global agriculture, but it was also a really short-lived endeavor. What started in earnest in about the 1840s was mostly over by the 1880s. Guano Island scattered across the world oceans had been tapped, and very little was left.
Even before it was over, folks were already saying, we have to do something different. Having this extractivist, boom-bust economy based on taking everything away and then leaving nothing behind, that's no way to build a country. That's no way to build a civilization, particularly in a place like Peru. What are we going to do when the guano's gone? Answer was, go to war with Chile, lose all of it, and be in economic ruin for 2 decades.
Another neighbor fights neighbor for natural resources story.
People looked at the guano industry as a lesson of maybe we should do things a different way. And also phosphate islands like Nauru, like Bonaba, like Makatea, which have hardly any phosphate left, are object lessons of what an extractivist economy does to a place. They leave it quite literally destroyed. Ecologically, also economically.
Though today, as Greg illustrated, you can still purchase guano in Peru and in specialty garden shops, most modern nitrogen fertilizer is instead made in factories, fueled by the Haber-Bosch process. But this chemical production, not unlike guano, is also bound by physical quantities of natural inputs.
The basic principle behind Haber-Bosch is that pure feedstocks of natural gas, of methane, are used as a fuel, but also as a feedstock that provides the hydrogen that latches onto the nitrogen after it's broken apart using immense amounts of heat and immense amounts of pressure to then create reactive nitrogen chemicals that can be used. Where do the hydrogen stocks come from? They come from natural gas production. Maybe we can use electrolysis of water to produce hydrogen using the wind energy and solar energy and things like this at times when there's too much. So maybe there's some promise that we can figure out a way to adapt the Haber-Bosch process to the use of renewable energy sources. Although this will require a remaking of the factories and the process itself.
A not insignificant amount of total greenhouse gas emissions can be traced directly to this process. Though, interestingly, alternatives are being experimented with. Tim Hammermich of the Future of Ag podcast actually did a recent episode featuring an organization called Nitricity, who is experimenting with a more climate-conscious fertilizer strategy. We'll link to the show in the show notes. In the meantime, though, the vast majority of the world's synthetic fertilizer is still being made the old-fashioned way, with all the attendant problems and risks.
Input-intensive agriculture isn't going to go away. The way we do it now, being so heavily dependent on fossil fuel extraction and on the extraction of phosphate and potassium from the earth itself, I don't think those things can continue for long. Or we've just ratcheting up the amount of global warming, the transformation of climate and current systems, and the sea level rise and other things that go along with that. One other thing I'll mention though too, nitrogen's one thing, but that's only one of the nutrients crucial for agricultural productivity. Phosphate and potassium are two other major ones. Then there's sulfur, then there's a whole list of other micronutrients as well. Where do we get our phosphate from? We get it from mines. And we've actually, looks like, passed peak phosphate already. We're on the decline in terms of the availability of this. And also, concerningly, we've mined it out in places like Florida, mined it out on the Pacific Islands. And increasingly, one country in the world, Morocco and its colony, Western Sahara, where at least half, maybe as much as 3/4 of the accessible world reserves of phosphate rely. You think the dominance of the petroleum industry by a set of Middle Eastern countries, Venezuela, Ecuador, and a couple of other countries is a problem? Think if one of the most vital things in the world for producing food is all in the hands of one single country. That is a geopolitical time bomb that's ticking and ticking and ticking. That's something to look out for in fertilizer's future.
The guano story in many ways was a gold rush tale. The thing that drove all the activity was physical, finite, and sometimes located in a geopolitical gray area, meaning that ownership of it, and thus the profit from its sale, was not a matter of building skill, of refining a technology or a process, or even managing a business successfully. It was simply a matter of who could get their hands on it first and who was willing to pay the most for it. Perhaps unsurprisingly, you could describe today's fertilizer market in a pretty similar way.
Speaking with people in the industry, the actual supply and availability is not really the issue. It's the whether you're willing to pay the price.
That's Sam Taylor. He's the executive director of research at Rabobank and an expert in ag inputs. He's here to bring us the other half of this story. Now that we've heard about the roots of the modern global fertilizer market, let's follow them out to the branches and understand how geopolitics, scarcity, and other factors well beyond the agricultural markets continue to dictate the rules of the global crop nutrient trade and how to deal with those risks today. Getting back to Sam, he broke down just a few of those exogenous factors that he says have conspired to disrupt supply and demand signals in fertilizer for the last couple of years.
Let's start at the start of the COVID crisis, basically, where one of the key producers of fertilizers, China, curtailed a lot of their industrial production. This has a lagged effect. They then limit some of their exports or they tighten the market. But then you start to see this from about August 2020, you started to see a groundswell of demand for commodities out of China from the North American market.
And on the other side, an increase in demand.
And this really started to rally commodity prices. And this then escalates the demand. Growers see a greater return on their investment. So they very often are a little bit more free-flowing with their application or those acres that they pull into production. So this kind of has the potential to tighten the balance sheet. And then you see a kind of sequence of other events. I mean, we go back to, I think it was February of 2021, you saw this Texas freeze that caused a shutdown of a lot of production. So again, this kind of ramps up the price a little bit. You then saw the Chinese curtailment of exports on urea and on phosphates, and this kind of tightens the global market that much further.
That's the third supply reducing shock and counting in the scope of 2.5 years.
And then actually in 3Q, 4Q of last year, we started to see what is happening right now in the European market, where you saw the shenanigans around supply of natural gas from the Russian market into Europe, causing the cost of production of nitrogen producers in Europe to spike so much that they were curtailing. They started curtailing, I think, probably around the September time period, October time period last year, which is kind of almost a little bit of a rinse repeat this year, where as we get into the higher gas demand environment in Europe, as we get colder months, flows of natural gas not coming quite so much. Nitrogen is a big suck on some nations' natural gas demand. And we see the cost of production and the relative spread in natural gas prices of the US versus North America make it unaffordable. And this kind of shifts this trade flow again. So the base case view on a lot of the nitrogen products at the moment between now and the end of the year is 20 to 30% increase in price. I think you could probably factor in a higher potential risk to the upside if worst case scenarios come to play on natural gas in Europe.
So to tally up, in the last 3 years, China has both suffered reduced production and then curtailed exports. North America was forced to reduce production and experienced increased demand. And finally, Europe has reduced production. And given demand increases for natural gas that are likely to occur this winter in Europe, it's safe to expect even more upward pressure on fertilizer prices as we go into the Northern Hemisphere winter and come out the other side. For Sam, Europe is the wild card here to watch. Not only because Russia's invasion of Ukraine has proven highly difficult to predict, but also because probably the most sensitive point of the modern fertilizer market is where it overlaps with the energy sector. In other words, it's the raw underlying resource, natural gas, that is making all the difference in modern markets, not necessarily how much technology we have or how many factories are online. And natural gas is not only used to make crop inputs. In fact, the market for natural gas is quite competitive. And if crop chemical manufacturers can't get it at the right price, it can quickly become cost prohibitive to make fertilizer at all. That's why the geopolitics of Eastern Europe continue to rankle, because today's fertilizer markets, like their predecessors, turn on who holds the raw input, natural gas, which is, in a lot of ways, the heir to the guano island. In this case, Russia has the resource, and Russia makes the decisions, which matters for Europe and for the rest of us.
At the moment, you see a cost of production in the European market, which is underwater for a lot of these producers. Reading one of the industry rags this week, I think that they estimated that somewhere like 22% of European ammonia production is in some form of curtailment, shutdown, something like that. The consequence of this is very often that when fertilizer producers don't have access or don't have the cost efficiencies to produce their own ammonia, they have to then import ammonia from other markets. And actually, nitrogen is fairly well integrated. So they then have to suck in the ammonia from markets. And so this can cause tightness, and you can see volumes shifting around. So what you're seeing is you're seeing a lot of imports of ammonia into the European market, which are then being upgraded into ammonium nitrate. And this is likely to continue through the rest of the year. And this is being pulled from North America. This is being pulled from the Caribbean. This is being pulled from the Middle East. This is being pulled from North Africa. And this is a displacement. So this is potentially causing more immediately small price reactions. But if there is any hiccup in this supply chain, and it's quite a thin needle to thread, this can have consequential volatility in other derivative markets.
Phrases like consequential volatility and derivative markets can cause eyes to glaze, I know. But the point here is well taken. If we visualize the flows of fertilizer in the world, what we basically have is a situation where the flow from China to the rest of the world has been significantly disrupted, then reduced. Same for the flow out of North America. At the same time, Europe and North America are sucking in more fertilizer than ever. And when it doesn't come readily from existing flows, it gets sucked in from nearby markets. Those nearby markets then turn to their neighbors, and soon a local natural gas price shortage in Europe cascades through the world's fertilizer markets, driving up the price of urea, UAN, and other products, and creating local and unpredictable scarcity in a sector whose value is incredibly dependent on having the right product in the right quantity at the right place and time. Supply chains have been widely blamed for contributing to this problem, but it's worth noting that Sam actually disagrees with the notion that supply chains have broken down. He sees them as operating as conservatively as possible in an incredibly risky situation.
We saw a massive elevation in potash pricing in the Brazil market, and that's because Brazil is 90-odd percent dependent upon imports for their fertilizers. And something like 46 or 47% of their potash needs comes from Russia and Belarus. So they couldn't afford to wait for the uncertainty of whether products are flowing. They needed it now. So the price mechanisms came into play. They elevated prices. They incentivized traders to get that product into that market at that time. So this is why you see a lot of noise in the market. Was the elevated price of potash indicative of a lot of the fundamentals in the market? Hindsight says no, but at the time, we couldn't wait to find out, because waiting to find out means rolling the dice, running the risk of whether or not you're going to get a crop out of the ground in one of the key growing regions in the world. That's a really profound risk to take.
On top of this risk, there are also more systemic issues. Belarus, for example, which exports more than 10 million tons of potash annually, has been shut out of its use of Baltic Sea ports. And switching to alternatives requires building port infrastructure and rail lines, not exactly short-term projects. But let's get down to some brass tacks. What does all this mean as producers stare down a growing mound of uncertainty around fertilizer prices ahead of the 2023 season? Sam looks at the data to answer this question, and finds evidence that farmers are already adapting to the new price environment.
So there is agronomic flexibility, even when you look at the macronutrients. And we've seen this in historic precedents. So you have to go back to like kind of a 2008, 2009 to find a comparable strain on grower affordability. And as such, we did see in large growing areas, and let's just talk about the Northern Hemisphere, Europe and North America, you saw growers cut back 10, 20, 25% application rates on some of these nutrients. And they have various elasticities. Nitrogen tends to be a little bit more inelastic, and P and K tend to be a little bit more elastic.
Elasticity here refers to the relationship between price and demand. In other words, N is inelastic, or even when the price goes up, growers still buy it. Whereas for P and K, price jumps are way more likely to lead to reduced demand and use.
But there wasn't necessarily this consummate or consequential fall off in yield. And this is related to agronomy. I mean, you fast forward 14 years and there has been a proliferation of technologies down to the grower level, which can further offset this, as well as a wider comfort and use with alternate supplementary complementary products. So the demand destruction is literally just a function of growers saying, I think I can match my returns here to their optimum by applying this much in this area versus doing a broad acre. And indicative of that was just the scale of soil testing that we have seen in the 2022 season versus other season. And I think that is just growers seeing that relative return of more efficacious fertilizers. If growers see that they can maximize their return by being more prescriptive, that's something that might stick. And certainly, I think when you look at the inventory in the channel at the moment, P and K have, there is a decent amount. And it's not just in the North American markets, also in the LATAM markets, but growers have just responded. And this will provide some price abatement for growers a little bit over the coming months.
Sam also reported the impression that beyond simply reducing or optimizing fertilizer use, there's also increasing interest amongst growers in new tech, in particular, biological fertilizer alternatives.
Even yesterday when I was on a webinar, there was this kind of reassessment of a lot of the terminology. Are some of these biological products, have they shifted from snake oil to legitimate benefits to growers in a higher input price environment? And we see very often that once these have been adopted and once they've been adopted in an effective way, so they've been a success, growers have been willing to keep using them in a diminished margin environment, a lower fertilizer price environment to a certain extent. So I think that there's something to be said this time is different, potentially, in certain contexts. So I think growers have lent on the kind of biological products, the biostimulants, the biofertilizers. And we do have, possibly slightly contrary to some of these synthetic options, we have a fairly rich pipeline of new products coming down the pipe.
All this forecasting about how farmers might continue to respond to higher fertilizer prices did beg the question, given all the uncertainty we've experienced in recent months, how do analysts like Sam feel confident continuing to make predictions?
I would say that no fertilizer analysts really shrouded themselves in glory over the last 18 months, just because so many of the factors that are coming down the pike are unpredictable. You don't necessarily have the ability to predict a sudden Texas freeze in February, or protectionist policies, or a conflict arising that's driving the market. And I think that, again, we've taken the coward's approach and been a little bit less deterministic on pricing rather than putting a direct number. You apportion a probability of it aligning within certain parameters. And I think this is possibly the market that we're going to be heading into for the foreseeable future. I remember being in Chicago in December, and this was the point at which the Russians were building up their troops around the Ukraine border. And you had to sit there going, look, they're not going to the Ukraine for a casual holiday. I was in the army, and I know what they do and they don't do. And so you had to, even at that point, caution that something was going to happen, or the probability of something was going to happen, or the market was going to react on the probability of something was going to happen. And I think we're now so in tune to these things happening that we have to take a broader view and factor in a lot of these probabilities. Weather is the one that's going to be the most volatile one, I think, even if we get it back into a more normalized geopolitical environment. But I don't see that we're anywhere close to a more normalized geopolitical environment. Maybe this is the paranoia in me, but I just see so many kind of risks to strongmen making unilateral decisions, populism causing unilateral decisions, the risks associated with potentially a broader conflict. We need a new phrase for a black swan, because there's black swans every other day. We need some other color of a swan to illustrate just the amount of risks that are coming down the pike. Do this with your scenarios more than anything else. And I think that's what we did that with the Russia-Ukraine crisis. We kind of factored in our original assumptions and then had a scenario as to how we thought it played out or how it impacted it.
There is a lot to learn from here. If you're someone whose business, directly or indirectly, depends on the ebbs and flows of global commodity markets, be they energy markets or grain markets. Here at AEI, we'd firstly disagree with the idea that predicting probabilities of outcomes rather than specific outcomes themselves is the cowardly approach, not least because what glory is there in being wrong? When thinking about the future, getting our minds around a probability can be more helpful. It leaves space for us to adapt. It's the difference between predicting, to use Sam's example, that potash prices will drop below $600 a ton versus predicting that there's a 75% chance that potash will drop below that price. In the first instance, conviction around the specific figure can sabotage your ability to seize on a low price when you see it. Because while you're waiting for $599 fertilizer, the price rose from $625 to $675. But probabilistic thinking allows us space to acknowledge that the price is low. It might go lower, but it also might go higher. Maybe all this sounds a bit like splitting hairs, but we know that how we think matters, and it does shape the way we make critical decisions. And if these ideas intrigue you at all, you should head over to aei.ag to learn more about becoming an AEI Premium subscriber. We do a lot of this kind of predicting at AEI. I did ask Sam, though, specifically, about his advice for growers around navigating the current fertilizer space. His recommendation?
The best and the simplest way to do this is always just to manage your cost of production to your estimated returns. So matching your cost of production to your marketing strategy. But again, that's not an easy thing to necessarily do, because if you all of a sudden feel that there's more upside in commodity prices, you might keep on wishing it up and it goes the other way. And it's never easy for growers.
If you were hoping for something more specific, you're not alone. Though there are some fascinating new fertilizer technologies in the works out there, a recommendation for learning more on that front, check out a forthcoming episode from our friends at AgTech So What on the future of fertilizer. We'll put a link in the show notes when it's available. Again, though there are some fascinating new fertilizer technologies out there, we are still mostly dealing with a problem that's been hundreds of years in the making. Large-scale fertilizer production, large enough to fuel continuous growth in agricultural productivity, has now and always has been constrained by a finite physical extracted resource, whether that's ancient bird poop on a distant Pacific island or natural gas under Siberian soils. That means that imperialistic saber-rattling and geopolitical brinksmanship will, for the foreseeable future, continue to be unavoidable inputs to the fertilizer market. It seems like this risk should motivate producers to seek alternatives when and if at all possible. For some, those alternatives might be synthetic fertilizers made with renewable resources. For others, they might be biological products. And for still others, it might be challenging the whole logic of extractive economics and developing their own novel ways to stoke soil and crop fertility with new practices and tools, or through rediscovering practices and tools that were abandoned hundreds of years ago under mountains of Pacific bird poop. In the meantime, the risk remains, not just for farms and fertilizer companies, but for whole economies, communities, and maybe even civilization as we know it. Revolutions in fertilizer have happened before, and another could be on the horizon. Whether your business is prepared to handle it is up to you. Needless to say, there is a lot more to this fertilizer story than we had time to unpack here today. Are you spending a lot of time thinking about what this sector might look like in 10, 30, 50 years? Do you have good theories about what are going to be big drivers of change? We'd love to hear about them. Talk to us on social media at Ag Economists or email us directly at askus@aei.ag. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and look out for Ag Economic Insights and the three of us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and on the website. And if you're hungry to learn more about the global fertilizer sector, consolidation in the industry, or the history and future of ag inputs as Sam Taylor sees it, check out the show notes for links to the extended interview. Well, folks, September 9th will soon come to an end, or maybe it's already long gone when you're listening. But the team here at Ag Interrupted is already excited for what's next. Ag Interrupted is a production of AEI Premium. I've been Sarah Mock. Special thanks to my co-hosts David Widmar and Brent Gloy, who were off this week, to show manager Emily Ranieri and Sarah Hubbard, and to the rest of the AEI team. If you haven't had enough ag history and economics, make sure to head to the website to learn more about becoming an AEI Premium subscriber. As a subscriber, you'll get access to a lot more content from the three of us. And here is a final fun note, some original research from Dr. Cushman.
The very first James Bond film, Dr. No, the novel on which it was based, was actually set on Dr. No's Caribbean guano island, which he was using his own guano industry, to hide his super secret base that he was using to try to take control of ICBM nuclear missiles and launches that the United States and the British government were making as part of the space race in the late 50s and the early 1960s. What if the original film Dr. No had ended not with the blowing up of the nuclear facility and Dr. No drowning in radioactive water, but instead, as it was in the book, with James Bond dumping 4 tons of pure Caribbean bird shit on top of Dr. No.
Until the next random but relevant date in ag history, stay curious, and we'll see you when we see you.